Hi, I'm Kana. I'm here with Kristen and Charlie, and we're excited to be back for another episode. This time we're talking about V.S. Naipaul, his first travelogue, and then two essays by Derek Walcott, The Muse of History and The Antilles, Fragments of Epic Memory. And I think I'll start us off with my first impression or overall assessment of the two thinkers. You know, it's debatable, but I find them to be kind of cynical in their own respect. I do think that they end up in different places with Naipaul. For some reason, I get that he's distanced himself after his translation from Trinidad to England. I think that he's fully, I guess, immersed himself in that landscape. And so he's more of a pro-assimilation, right? And then you got Derek Walcott, who, although he understands himself as a West Indian, he still has that tense relationship with history, which is why I see them both as, I guess, a kind of cynic. But what do you all think?
I think that's interesting that you see them both as cynics. I automatically saw V.S. Naipaul as a cynic, and I was like, I don't know if Walcott is, just because Walcott, for me, feels so hopeful, and I think he works through the turmoil of his relationship to the Caribbean, but I also think that he's like, all right, we got to do something about this. Like, we got to move on. So I think I didn't imagine him as cynical, but I think that makes sense, like all the imagery on just like bitter and tart and fruit and like brokenness. And like I see how this emphasis and this wading through can come off as cynical.
Yeah, I agree. I think cynicism is a fun place to start. Because I agree, Walcott seems to find a kind of middle ground, but he does really have some of that harshness with cutting off your ties from your past in this way that I think it's really easy for him and anybody who comes after the Surrealists. It's easy for anybody who's writing in the wake of the Surrealists to be like, that nostalgia for Africa stuff is like so, you know, lame and lazy and lofty and idealistic. And like, but I do think Naipaul, I said both names at once. I think Walcott is threading that needle where he is like Fanon, he's like, you have to reject this father figure. You have to be going somewhere new. But he also is embracing of language. He's like, language is mine. And he like really believes in the possibility of like Antillean art and poetry.
I like that correlation that you just made between Fanon and Walcott, because I mean, it makes sense to put them together, especially where Professor Jabinski talks about the time of like when all of them are born and thinking together, whether they're actually in conversation with each other or not. But I was so opposed to Fanon's New World. So I was like, it seems so chaotic, hectic, scary. And then with Walcott, I'm like, I'm really embracing it. I'm like, yes, language and art and making something anew. And so I'm interested in how that, I don't know if it's tone or what it is, but I'm interested in how that influences my belief in one versus the other. Yeah. And then there was something you mentioned in the beginning about, I think it was Naipaul. I think we can move on. But yeah,
No, but I do agree with you. I had a similar, I guess, switch in reception with Fanon and Walcott. I do agree that the way that he, like his rhetoric is more effective. I don't know how it is. It's like when he says something, you can't say no to it, right? Where he's just like, okay. I think it's when he's talking about how fragmentation, like I think the question that we get from Walcott sometimes is, how do you narrate an unintelligible history? You know, And I'm like, okay. And he's like, in fragments. And I'm like, well, sure, you know, but why should we assume that a fragment is this spontaneous thing, right? Like, why a fragment came, it's a shard of a whole. But he's like, no, stop reaching, right? Call a duck if it quacks. Like, he's really, like, he has this emphasis on, I guess, the genuine experience that comes from inhabiting a place that can't be mimicked or imitated. And I think he feels like reality is there and that's where you find your identity or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Walcott.
Well, you know, one of the things too, like the add to your introduction of the cynical and also thinking about how he is approaching the shards is the term that Professor Drabinsky used, which was immanent critique. Mm-hmm. I think that's what it was. And I feel like that's probably the core of that cynicism. Or that's where I feel like it's like, because he's waiting in it for so long. It's almost like, oh, this is not where what you believe. It's just that you understand it so well. And that, to me, is like the deep correlation with Fanon in a way that I didn't process before, that they're both making this super accurate assessment of the way white or European colonialism has produced an image of blackness or nativeness. So yeah, this is, thank you. This is really enlightening for me. Thank you.
You know, what makes me think about, I think you're totally right to point out the immanent critique with Fanon and how Walcott is really inhabiting these like really deep critiques about history and the possibility of art and stuff. And then he's also using that same technique on Naipaul in the Antilles essay, because he's going to Trinidad and he's like, he's also like, yeah, traveling to these places where where he feels that Naipaul should be like looking in this way that he is trying to demonstrate. You can look. Maybe that's just like a more petty version of immanent critique, but it is like him, like putting, like using form to put through his message.
Yeah. I think it's petty, but I also think that's what his intention was.
Totally.
It was like, come here and like look differently.
Yeah.
Cause like I'm in the same place that you're in and I'm just seeing the world completely differently because it's a perspectival shift.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I completely see that.
It's diabolical though. I can't imagine being, cause he's also on the pedestal of literature. Mm-hmm. Like he's giving his Nobel speech.
Right.
And he's like, oh, watch V.S. Naipaul, you could have won a Nobel if you were just...
You saw things a little differently.
Yeah. In your backyard? They're not from the same place.
Yeah. So they're both, right, Nobel Prize winners. And that's something that I haven't really been able to pull out, but I've been thinking about literacy and what it does to the mind, or, you know, that section we talked about in Walcott, where he was like, well, the fisherman knows who he is. You know what I mean? And I was just thinking about that differential, you know, and who becomes, or like who takes on an existential crisis, once, I guess, they're enlightened or, you know, it's interesting that they're both, their inheritance is, a specific kind of literacy, even Fanon's, right? And Walcott's like, well, I'm not giving it back. I'm going to, I guess, remake. He's all about the rebirth instead of giving back to. I'm not sure.
Yeah, the literacy is interesting because I think even there's obviously literacy of text, of writing, of the written word. But then I'm also processing it as literacy of the psyche versus the farmer's literacy of the land and the, is it seaman?
I think it was a seaman.
Fisherman.
Fisherman.
Right.
Peasant in the
One of the other ones
that is more associated with water. It'll be literacy of the sea, right? So I'm just, I'm interested in how the literacy of the psyche is more disruptive and, he says it's like self mutilating almost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that makes me think of the way the surrealists, they wanted to develop. Or the surrealists and their desire to get people to emphasize connection to the land,
mm-hmm.
and the like that kind of literacy that you were talking about with respect to the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
That's like I think Walcott is like respecting a certain literacy among this like alienation of consciousness is not as intense,
mm-hmm.
But also like there's a contradiction there,
mm-hmm.
because Walcott's kind of, and the surrealist too, like to kind of activate a people through art, you need a literate public. So can you have both? Can you have the like the peasant and the fisherman who is like perfectly connected to all of these things? Mm-hmm. But then if you give the peasant like Marx and you kind of like introduce, or Freud or whatever, and you like introduce the peasant's own alienation to himself, like that's necessary for a certain political project.
Right.
But now you've kind of lost that, maybe. Maybe you haven't. I don't know.
I personally am curious about whether they already have that political consciousness and like whether they need the literacy of Marx per se.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think I was like the examples I was giving in class towards the end where I think about people who are like intentionally opting out, like the whole idea. I mean, let me not say the whole idea, but to condense Marx, is like how to opt out of the system of capitalism, and with obviously this really intense survey of what capitalism is and what it does to people. I'm curious about whether these people that are connected to land and water also have a political consciousness that where we don't have to bring certain things to them. And I think that's part of the focus, or at least where Walcott, I think, is trying to make a turn to be like, okay, these are the people that we can be learning from. And mm-hmm. We don't necessarily have to think about all the ways that we can compare ourselves and contextualize a Marx in this environment.
I think it's a great point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there is another thing that I wanted to bring up, and it is, we didn't talk about it much in class, but this heavy emphasis on the Adamic, the Garden of Eden, the apple. There's like constant references to the Bible. And I think part of it, which was interesting to me, is thinking about them as metaphor, like the way he's using them as metaphor to do some of that myth bursting and myth making process. And at the same time, I'm thinking about how it felt very literal, because he's writing at a time where Sylvia Winter is also writing. I didn't check the dates to see when, say, Unsettling the Coloniality of Being, whether that was written, how far it was written from Walcott's work, but they are living in the same generation, the same era. Mm. And we know that Winter is thinking about Christianity very literally and thinking about the derivatives of Christianity, or the derivatives of what Walcott calls the Manichaean God,
mm-hmm.
And how it shows up in the political sphere and the biological sphere, to govern people. And yeah, so I'm just interested in how they show up metaphorically and literally, but they feel like they're doing a lot of the same work.
I do think, because I think that comes up too, I think it's in the Muse of History, and we talked about it a little bit in class, how he kind of flips between the two, where he's like, well, I'm not talking about a religious faith. But I do think Walcott acknowledges that, I guess, a part of refinement and culture does take place through religion, and that he talks about it somewhere in the Muse of History. I'll have to find it, but it was a part of, I guess, how the enslaved were becoming, I guess, men again, was in believing, you know, starting to believe in Christianity and things like that. So I think we'll have to check the dates, but he might be an interlocutor with Winter in that respect, where he's tracking that transition from that understanding of man as a religious subject.
Yeah. I found where you probably are referencing on page 48, bottom.
Yes.
When he says, "A slave master now encountered a massive pliability. Mm-hmm. The slave converted himself. He changed weapons, spiritual weapons, and as he adapted his master's religion, he also adapted his language. And it is here that what we can look at as our poetic tradition begins."
Right.
"Now began the new naming of things." And again, heavily biblical reference, where it's like, you know, God is naming all of the things that as he's producing the world. So I think that's so, this idea of like writing oneself into being, or like whatever the medium is, like producing oneself through religion, which is the emphasis that he's making when he focuses on religion and Muse of History.
And that connects to Winter, I think, too, where Winter traces like where this kind of, she observes how supernatural essence is like first in the cosmos, and then it's in the natural world, and then it becomes within a person or within the individual.
Yeah.
So I think we're still in that world, but Walcott is turning it into something with like the power of creation, with a capital C, to like regenerate a new kind of faith, a new kind of culture. Yeah. Like, I think he has like faith, culture, and humanity, like, and civilization, similar to the surrealists. Yeah. It's all like tied into, and poetry.
Yeah.
They're all sort of interconnected, and they think that there's just what's missing is the poet to step in and just breathe life into those things. Mm-hmm. They're waiting.
Yeah. He even emphasizes Percy and Cesare, and like how different they are. But like, if we look at how similar they are, both of them are, they're apprehensive about what the worlds are that they can see, and what the worlds are that they can't, and what do they do with that. But then they can move past that by creating the word he uses, numinous, like numinous language. And I was like, yeah, that's the relationship to the divine.
I am also looking and seeing that he describes the comparison with Percy and Cesare is so awesome to read. I thought that was such an incredibly interesting part of this essay. And I'm noticing that he uses tartness to describe the tonal qualities of the poets and what they share.
Yeah.
So that's pretty, like, that's what's so cool about this. The way Walcott writes is that every single thing is interconnected with itself. I would love to linger on that comparison for a minute, because he's making a really radical case about language and its possibilities, and also he the numinosity mm-hmm. or whatever, mm-hmm. he also argues there's like a shared essence between them, mm-hmm. which really makes me think of Césaire and the idea of a shared Caribbean essence.
Mm-hmm.
But whereas Césaire was talking about it, like this essence transcends like the diaspora and the like native land, Walcott's keeping it more. Walcott's, it is crossing, like, this is something that we share, not from a, like, a racialized essence, but from, like, a
yes.
essence of place.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So am I understanding that right? Because I thought with, when he talks about the tartness and yeah. impatience, like, he was referring specifically to, this is on page 49, towards the end, to Césaire's tonality.
Oh, really? Did I misread
right?
that?
I don't know if it's misread or it seems like even at the end of that passage where he was like, as an Antillean, I feel more akin to Césaire's tone. He was talking about yeah. how he would rather, I think, like, it was something he had said where he was like, if I needed to replicate in English, because they're both written in French, he was yeah, like, right, I would right. replicate Percy's, you know, because it's simpler.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But the one, I guess, that I guess is more, I guess, true to him is that abstruse and tone of the creolization that of French that he's still sensing, even though Césaire's French is, you know, impeccable. He's just like, there's an underbelly to that.
Totally.
That he can relate to as an Antillean.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think you mentioned it too, Kristen, in class, where you were like, it was hard to follow Walcott because he goes in and out. You're like, is he on the side of the new world poet? Or is he on right. this side? Yeah. Right? Like, is it Kumbaya? Or
right, right. right.
is, you know, like,
totally.
You
totally.
Know, but I, you know, I still think that it's important and that it was helpful for me, or engaging with him was productive for me. To think about, I guess, the ways that we can, what was it we talked about in class? Destabilize or unsettle the way that we understand memory and history.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's just been challenging us in that way, I think.
Yeah, that was so core for me. I think it's core for the essay, The Muse of History, mm-hmm. where he is emphasizing that myth is the function of history, and I was like, what is, does he not like memory? Like, what's his thing with memory? Because he says, for them, history is fiction, mm-hmm. subject to a fitful muse, memory. He's talking about New World writers.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, I guess it's not either or, I think is obviously what he's saying, but it's like, you have to understand that history is myth, but it relies on the memory of the person who's telling the history. Mm-hmm. So at the end of that paragraph that I just read on 37, he says, everything depends on whether we write this fiction through the memory of hero or of victim.
Yeah.
So in other words, everything depends on who is mythologizing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
So yeah, it was really interesting to think about that, and also think about how he's considering time, because time is a function of history, or at least our telling of it.
Right.
Mm. Yeah, you just brought a lot into this. I'm not sure how to respond to it. Yeah, I thought it, when you say memory, I'm trying to like recover what I remember him saying about memory, and mm-hmm. he doesn't engage. Not that he doesn't engage it. He's obviously saying a lot about memory, but he doesn't use the word a lot.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's kept marginal for a real reason.
Yeah. If I can take a gander.
Please.
Why he's not using memory as much. I think he is trying to veer away from these grasp, like this impossible grasp, because memory is unfit. Like, it's going to waver, it's going to wait. In fact, it's going to be destroyed in multiple ways, particularly within the traumatic experiences via enslavement and indentured servitude. So I think the reliance on memory might be
like unstable.
Yeah, that's a better word than I was going to use. I'm not going to say the word I was going to use. It's unstable. So I think what he's trying to emphasize is that we have to understand that it's unstable. And what we do with the little pieces of the memories that we understand is jagged, that we understand is sometimes aggrandized, is figure out how we put them together as these like pieces. So we talked about the vase as like one of the critical images that he provides for us. And he's more concerned about the thing that holds these memories together, the glue or yes. whatever the white.
And the structure that they build.
Yes, yes. So I think that's what it is.
I think that's a, yeah. Yeah, I think that's beautifully put and totally spot on.
Yeah. It's definitely, I think, an attachment like that he is exposing that many of us have to history, right? I think one of the questions that was asked was like, why would you want India? Africa, or like in light of all that's happened, in light of the father that sold you and the one that bought you, right? Like, why do you want that? Like, I think he's exposing that it is, like you said, it's unstable and lofty to be holding on so tightly to something that I guess doesn't reflect or mirror the structure that's built from. I guess, celebrating what's happening right now. I think he mentions that city, Felicity, mm-hmm. right? The beauty of that festival that was happening, in, you know, instead of trying to compare it to something that might have been happening in Hindu India.
Yeah.
I don't know why, before I started that, I was thinking about Naipaul's Middle Passage and, like, I guess the picture he's painting of the Caribbean through his travelogue, right? Like, I guess maybe I'm thinking about it because it's like, why would you want that? As a Caribbean reading it, I'm like, man, like, he's showing all the not so hot parts of
indeed, yeah,
you know, all the colorism, yeah, dirty laundry, and the,
yeah,
you know. Yeah. But what was your takes on reading the Middle Passage? You know, your reception of it.
I think thinking about history across both of them is really fruitful, because there were these sections where it's like almost entirely like also the way you, this is how you describe this too. Okay. Now the travelogue is very like spare with like analysis. It's like really just like, it gives you this, all of this character and narration and summation in some ways, or like, this is how they talked, this is what they talked about, but there's not as much analysis. But he does have these like weird sections about Columbus. And I was, it was like, it always stood out as this like real break. And I was even kind of looking through it in class and I was like, what is this trying to say?
Right. About
And it is like right before, it's, you know, page 28, 29.
Okay.
Right before he gets to, you know, the big kicker about, nothing was created in the West Indies. Mm-hmm. And it seems like he read like one Alan Burns book of history.
Mm-hmm.
Like he said, the footnote is these quotations and many others in this book are taken from this one other book. So.
It's like the travelogue practice of the past that Trabinsky was talking about, where it's like, I'm going to read this one thing that someone said, and I'm going to make an entire determination of a group of people across time, across space.
Right.
From that one.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like that is reason for Walcott to say like, dude, you're not looking hard enough. You right. know, like you're seeing what you want to see, which is like, you're the smartest person on the boat. You have all this kind of like high ground. You can make jokes. It's very like interesting to read. It's, you know, it's like there's this relationship between you and your reader because you're both like observing this kind of like disaster.
Right.
And it's this kind of like tragic story that you can kind of try to tell. And it's, yeah, it's all this aesthetic material.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's like, I kept wondering, like, is that just a limitation of the genre of a travelogue? Because I feel like I feel as though Naipaul has a lot more insight than he reveals in the travelogue. Being an Indo-Caribbean, I feel like there's a gap that he can fill with his own lived experience that, for the purposes of this project, he's like, I'm just gonna, I guess, revel in the privilege that I get of being able to fit into these higher class, you know, like he's,
yeah,
at some points in the travelogue, I was assuming that he was white because they were just, he almost got attacked by some of the immigrants who thought that he had like ill intent as he's like scribbling down furiously.
Oh yeah.
That
was really funny actually.
And I'm like, is he white? But he's not. It's just his, I guess, his relation or his proximity to,
yeah, he was read as completely.
Exactly.
And a threat to them.
Like, how well had he assimilated that there was no connection between him and people who are from the same place that he's from, you know?
He's not one with the peasant.
He was not.
He's not one with the peasant. I'm thinking so many things that I hope it comes out intelligible. But this idea of separating the self from, or I don't know if he's actually separating himself. I feel like he feels separated by the throes of history and by the throes of colonialism and et cetera. And so I think that detachment is very palpable to the people that he's around. And they are, I'm sure they are conscious based off of their response. They're conscious of that, what that detached outward looking in, experience is like. And so they're like, yeah, don't write anything about me. Like, what are you doing? Why are you here? Mm-hmm. Why are you not doing the things that all of us are doing? And so I think that's interesting. And I also think there's something with how much this travelogue, although it's saying something about Caribbean people, is actually saying something about himself. And yeah. So I think you brought this up, Kena, but the idea that it's just representative of his feelings. Like, it's representative of him being unsettled, and it's coming out in the distance that he has from the text, the people, everything. And at the same time, I must say, there were certain things that I'm like, I just, like you said, Kena, you like feel the, you're like, oh yeah, this is, you're exposing us. So on the bottom left of 22, he is saying, as England, the last paragraph, top of the last paragraph, as England receded, people prepared more actively for the West Indies. So there's this understanding that being in the West Indies has this different orientation or different relationship to other people, to space, mm-hmm. And they formed color groups, race groups, territory groups, money groups, which is, it was like division, division, division. And then he says, the West Indies being what they are, no group was fixed. One man could belong to all.
Yeah.
And when he says that, I thought about the guy that I'm probably not going to find it now, but he was talking about a specific group of people, and then he got caught up because somebody basically either started speaking the language or
right.
something happened. He was like, oh, yeah, he got real quiet. I think it was Carrera.
Right, Carre or something. Yeah, right, yeah, it was the whole spat with Portuguese, mm-hmm. and he thought no one could speak Portuguese.
Right
there.
Yeah, when you were talking, when you pointed us to this, it did make me think of something Walcott said about how in time, like Caribbean. Like ethnic identity is going to be like so mixed and it's not going to be really intelligible. Like people's individual like roots are not going to be intelligible. And I feel like Naipaul's pointing to like how. Oh, and another thing that Walcott discusses about the Eden, a port of Spain. Mm-hmm. And what makes it so rich is how abundant it is and how
yeah.
I keep thinking of Winter's term transculturalism. Mm-hmm. And I think that applies to what you're saying.
Yeah.
Miscegenation. I don't know how to pronounce that word, but it comes up in one of Walcott's texts, mm-hmm. like that mixing.
Mm-hmm. That's so fascinating to think about, like how so many people are so immersed in all of the different groupings. Like there's clear differentiation, but there's also people that are sliding in and out of these groups. And thinking about that as a distinct Caribbean identity that he himself can't achieve.
That's really interesting to think about that like the level of mixture, the kind of archipelago aspect where there are so many microcultures. Like, it's not quite, that is kind of unique.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's not the state of the United States. You know, I think that's something people like to say a lot in terms of, I mean, sure, there are different, like race and class certainly have different dynamics in different American communities. But it's not quite as volatile and like it's certainly not like talked about all the time among everybody.
Yeah. Volatile is the word. I don't know if it's very volatile, but I was thinking of how a Black Chicago is so distinct from a Black New Orleans, from a Black Brooklyn, you know? So it's like, then, and how.
I guess instead of the cultures themselves, I'm definitely not saying that the cultures are homogenous, but the way the structures respond to people based on how they look. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, I would totally agree. Any closing thoughts we might want to offer? Has your perspective changed through the conversation a little bit? Do you still think that Walcott is a cynic?
I'll say he's more of a realist. And I feel like in class, I was slow to the Walcott train on fragmentation, but I am convinced now that, you know, that narwhal fragmentation needs repair, or, you know, in the way that we think, right? Like, we don't need to have this singular point of origin for something beautiful to come from it. So I'm excited for this shift that we've taken from surrealism into our postmodern, you know, thinkers. So,
yeah, I think my mind just opened up from, so I don't know what I fully agree with or what I fully disagree with, but I think I'm just more aware of the different takes and how people are approaching Caribbeanity differently. And I think I'm most intrigued by the idea of the distortion of time and space through myth-making.
I wonder if Gleason will have anything on that. Thank you guys for this conversation.
Thank you.
It was really fun to talk to you.
Yeah. Until next time.